now for nearly 60 years and having most of my life haranguing people at street corners, and still I have come to this meeting with a sense of diffidence, for the simple reason that here in this meeting I cannot speak in the language which I spontaneously speak. I cannot claim even a nodding acquaintance with the English language, which I have been asked to use as a medium of communication with you. I am afraid I may not be able to convey all the nuances, not only of my thinking, but of my feeling also, in the language which I seldom use. I shall therefore crave your indulgence and hope you will bear with me for any inadequacy of expression as I may betray in the course of this speech. I am reminded on this occasion of one question which J. Krishnamurti asked me with his characteristic earnestness. "Sir, is there an Indian mind?" And I found myself at a loss to answer that question at the spur of the moment. This question has occurred to me on more than one occasion whenever I look at the situation, not only in this country but in the whole world. I shall make my meaning more clearly understood by relating an anecdote. I usually went from Nagpur to Delhi with my friend Mr. H.V. Kamath in his car. On one occasion, we made a short halt at Agra, and Kamath asked me to show his driver the world known Taj Mahal. I took him. I was a man of letters, as I have been regarded by people, but he was not a man of letters, he was illiterate, but a man of sense. So after having a careful look at the town hall, he asked me a question which had never occurred to me. He asked me, "Who lives here?" Being a man of letters, with my book learning, this question had never occurred to me, because it requires an original mind to ask such a question. I said, "No one lives here." "Then what is this place? Is it a school?" I said, "No." "Then a hospital?" "No." "Is it a hotel?" Because he had heard of the Taj Mahal Hotel at Bombay. I answered in the negative. then what in the world is this place? I said, it is a mausoleum, a sepulcher. Then he said, oh, for God's sake, why did you bring me to this graveyard? In the early morning, which you all regard as Ram Prahar, the time to pray. And his answer has always haunted me. What are we going to make of this world? A sepulchre of humanity or a house for man to live, beautiful, entire and clean? That is the question which the revolutionaries have got to ask. So the question they ask, that I ask myself, is there a revolutionary mind? Because the first condition, the second condition and the third condition of revolution is a revolutionary mind. And I hope that the youth of this country have this revolutionary mind. I see some young faces in this meeting, among the audience. As a matter of fact, I have fallen in love with youth. It's a rare pleasure at my age to see life in its full blossom. And youth is life blooming, life in blossom. That is why I have fallen in love with youth. Because we have no one else to depend upon. The future is theirs. They have the whole of life before them. While I had had my day, and perhaps I am now only fit for retiring. I am reminded of a parable. An old man went for a walk in a park with his grandson. You know, one of the distinguishing characteristics of old age, that an old man always grumbles. He is cross with the whole world, cross with God, cross with man, cross with himself. So he complains, keeps complaining all the time. He is Mr. Grumble. Let us call him. The first thing that Mr. Grumble saw was a sturdy tamarind tree. And he began to comment. He said, the creator doesn't seem to have any sense of proportion. Look at this mighty tamarind tree. It has such small leaves and such small fruit. Couldn't he show a better sense of proportion? If he had not the sense to make a better world, why didn't he consult experienced men like me? He could have made a better world. And you know, Vishwamitra Rishi tried to make a better world. With what wisdom? we all know. So they began their stroll through the park with the old man making a running commentary on everything that he saw. At last they came to a bed of roses, and the old man said, "Well, this is the limit. I could tolerate everything but this. This creator seems to me to have had no sense of aesthetics either, and no milk of human kindness in his soul. He has in his creation even roses bear thorns." The young child, his grandson, was enjoying everything because everything was fresh to him, new to him. He had no preconceived notions. He had a fresh mind. So he asked his grandfather to take another round. And as the second round began, as chance would have it, a tamarind fruit dropped on the bald head of this old man. And the grandson asked, "Grandpa, what would have happened if this tamarind was as big as a pumpkin?" So the old man began to think, to ponder, because he was face to face with reality, and said, "Yes, it seems there is some meaning in the creation and some design behind this providence of the Almighty. He seems to have made the tamarind fruit so small, if for nothing else, at least to save my bald head." So the outlook of the youth is robust. It is never vanquished. It's neither the imagination nor the hope of youth. Elder people will go on complaining that roses bear thorns, but young men will be thankful that thorns bear roses. That's the robust outlook, which is the revolutionary outlook. The old man will also ask, "Is this possible?" Yesterday, as I was addressing members of the bar, I was telling them, this is a question which no revolutionary will ever ask. This is a question peculiar to the politician, because politics is the art of the possible. And what is revolution? The art of making the impossible possible. It's a glorious, a romantic adventure. This vision, as well as the advent of revolution. And let us hope that our young men and women will be the harbingers of a glorious new age, greater, better, and more beautiful. What is the first requisite? The first requisite is an open mind, A revolutionary mind is an open mind, and an open mind is an uncommitted mind. A mind that is committed to no opinions. A revolutionary mind has no opinions, no views, and it takes nothing on credit. From no personality, no hero, however great he may have been. Not even a hero of the stature of Gandhi and Marx. A revolutionary mind is an open mind. Doesn't accept ideas. It's a mind that is not subservient to any ideology. What is ideology after all? Ideology is organized thought. That which we call a school of thought. And all organized thought is frozen thinking. When thinking ceases, thought begins. Accumulated thought, that is lifeless, without any energy in it, is known as ideology. Organized thought is ideology. And when ideology, organized thought, becomes defensive, it becomes what we call an ism. Organized thought, that is, that becomes aggressive. A thought that wants to conquer other thoughts, to vanquish other thoughts, other ideologies. So it's not intelligence, it's the reverse of intelligence. Because it wants to vanquish all other thoughts. They say Shankaracharya started on a pilgrimage of Digvijay. And Swami Vivekananda has been called by Romain Rolland the Napoleon of Hinduism. Conquest of other organized thought is simply violence to the intelligence of man. And when this organized aggressive thought plumps for power, wants to conquer power, it is called a party. Organized thought is ideology, aggressive organized thought is ism, and aggressive organized thought, which wants to conquer, which seeks to conquer power, is a party. So all these are anti-intelligence. They are a slur on a contumely on the intelligence of man. What is needed is not thought or ideology, but thinking. Thinking is quite different from thought. Thinking flows. It is dynamic. It is a running stream. And thought is the stagnant water of a pool, however clear it may be, however transparent. So what is needed for revolution is thinking and not thought. Thought is thinking at second hand. That is vicarious thinking. You borrow ideas and thoughts from others. So you live at second hand. You don't lead an original life. So if you go to the people and speak to them about this revolution, do not give them ideas for God's sake. Stimulate thinking. Exhort them to think for themselves. Because the common citizen is the sovereign in a democratic dispensation. And where is this citizen? He seems to have been lost. God has gone to sleep, and the common man has been lost in oblivion in this age of science, which threatens to convert this world into the mausoleum of humanity. What are we going to do in this country? We old men, as well as young men, who have shirked so far thinking for themselves. Leadership is different from following an ideology. We could follow a leader for certain collective action, but we cannot accept his thoughts on credit, because it often happens, more often than not, that we don't hold opinions, our opinions hold us. Instead of the dog wagging the tail wags the dog. So we have to be on the alert in this respect. We shall not tread the beaten path, but explore new pathways to our goal. And what is that goal? To establish the dignity of man. We have insulted man traditionally in this country. That is why, in spite of its wanted spirituality, we have been more often slaves than free men. Can spirituality ever tolerate slavery? And we have so many spiritual preceptors in our country with tremendous following. And why has this country been a country of subject people for the most part of its history? The answer is, we have never cared for the dignity of man as man, unlabeled man. You will pardon me if I have the temerity to say that our country is not a country of spirituality, but a country of religiosity. Religion is not only different from spirituality, sometimes Well, oftentimes it is anti-spiritual. What is religion? Organized religion. What is organized religion? What are the factors that are common to all religions? The first is faith in God. Second is good character. And third is our dealings with other men, other animals, and our attitude to nature. These three things are common to all religions in the world. And as it happens in mathematics, because they are common, they are cancelled. What remains is known as religion. I am a Hindu. I tell lies. There is a Muslim friend also who tells lies. And still we are Hindus and Muslims. Because telling lies is common, as telling the truth also is common. So the common term is cancelled. And what is left is known as religion, which is concerned not with life in this world, not with liberation of the soul, but life after death. So religion is otherworldliness and not spirituality. We are a religious people and have never been a spiritual people. Though we have, in our philosophy, attained to serene heights of spirituality, but so far as our relations with other men are concerned, with our fellow men are concerned, we have always led not a life of duplicity, but a life of split personality. We have lived on two levels, on the religious level and on the mundane level at the same time. We have been blowing hot and cold in the same breath. That is why we have been able to achieve nothing except respect for what our forefathers have achieved in their day. So I have asked myself, is there an Indian mind? And in the present context, is there an Indian citizen? Have we any Indian leaders now? Barring those who have survived the Gandhian era. They are soon becoming yesterdays and will very soon be gathered with their fathers. They'll join the majority. What about the rest who have to live in this country? Can you think of a single person whom you could call a leader of India's stature? We have posts. We have All India posts, All India offices, but no Indian citizen. We have only regional leaders, parochial leaders, littleness on stilts, pygmies strutting before the footlights in garments borrowed from giants. If you remove their chairs, their All India posts, All India offices are there. Many people in this country who know them. C. Raja Gopalacharya was a leader of Indian stature. He was as well known in Kashmir as in Madras. Jayaprakash Narayan happens to be the last survival of these Indian leaders, the last surviving personality. So friends, if we want a total revolution, we have to begin with an Indian mind. And I wonder, sometimes I am surprised and frightened out of my wits to see that it is these young men and women studying in our universities who are the foremost in fighting for localism, for multinationalism, for regional particularism, for emergent identities that are smaller than many countries in Europe. This seems to me the prevalent rage world over. Ivan Illich has recently come out with a book on the celebration of awareness. And what this does this awareness mean? It connotes your roots. Your roots means your separatist identity. Which identity isolates you? This feeling of particularism puts you on the defensive, and nothing isolates as an attitude of defense. The result is that we have several specimens, several varieties of citizenship in this country, except citizenship unqualified, unadulterated, unmodified. Citizenship simple and unalloyed. Except this, we have all varieties of citizenship. The first variety is denominational citizenship. I shall, for your convenience, try to define what this denominational citizenship means. When you make your denomination, your creed or your community, the basis of your citizenship, the basis of your nationality, you are communal. This is the nearest approach to a logical definition of communalism. Maulana Muhammad Ali, in the heyday of his popularity, once uttered a very controversial remark in one of the mosques at Delhi. He said, "I am first a Muslim and then an Indian." Sarojini Nayudu replied with an equally emphatic aphorism. She said, "I am a Bengali by birth, an Andhra by marriage, a Muslim by residence," because she lived in the domains of the Nizam, "and an Indian first, second and last." There was one leader in Punjab. He was a barrister, Dr. Muhammad Alam. Someone asked me, "Dr. Alam, what are you? First a Muslim or first an Indian?" He said, "It's a wrong question. How, you don't know how to put the right question. If you want to put me the right question, it will be, whom do you belong to first, your mother or to your father?" And my reply is, "I belong as much to my mother as to my father, and because I belong to both, I am their son. I am Muhammad Alam." I think that's the reply that should spontaneously occur to every man, every Indian who wants a revolution to change the present order of things from top to bottom and in all realms of human consciousness. Our national movement began with revivalism, and we who took active part in national education thought that we were imparting real national education to our pupils. Lala Lajpat Rai, after his return from America, wrote a book on national education, and he made a confession in that book. The education that we imparted in our national schools was denominational in character. So revivalism gave birth to what is known as Vedantic nationalism. But not nationality in the sense in which we want it for the success of a revolutionary movement.